Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
We are in the Torah portion, Vayeshev, which is Genesis chapter 37 through chapter 40. There's a lot of stuff in here. We're going to cover every detail, every nuance of it is too much. There'll be a few details we'll cover about today, hopefully. Before we go into my little spiel, are there any comments, questions, or issues you had with this story? Yes, Larry.
The older brother who said, don't kill him.
Oh, Reuben. There's a lot to Reuben. Reuben is by definition, he's a dynamic character. Though we don't know a lot about him, the story, there are things he does throughout his life that affect him and change his character as time goes on. And it's interesting to see, even though he's a relatively minor character, you still see in his life, you see the man changing over time. Anyway, he was affected by it. Yep, it affected his whole life, felt responsible for everything that had happened here. Which is interesting because he's a firstborn. But he screwed up, no pun intended, regarding his father.
Okay, so what is the deal with the Ishmaelites, then the Midianites, and the Ishmaelites, and then the Midianites? And then the Ishmaelites sold him. So it was first the Ishmaelites, they saw the Ishmaelites,
right?
And then they were Midianites, and they sold him to the Ishmaelites, and then the Midianites went to Egypt, and then the Ishmaelites sold him in Egypt.
Right.
So I know they're pretty much in the same geographical area,
the
Ishmaelites and Midianites.
Yeah.
But very rarely in the Torah does it make these seemingly non-important changes without having a deeper hidden lesson or meaning inside.
That's an interesting question. So regarding the toggling back and forth between Ishmaelites and Midianites, I've only done minor looking into that, not major, so I can't give you a strong answer. I give you little partial details that both descendants are from Abraham, obviously. They're both literally Abraham's children. He had Midian was his son and Ishmael was his son. Both live in the same territory. In the explanation when Abraham had children, the dominant territory was given to Ishmael. But as it said with Keturah, all of his concubine, he had multiple sons. He said all of his sons the same territory as Ishmael. But if you look at Ishmael's genealogy, the Torah lists all of the sons he had, and it says they were all 12 princes. He had 12 princes, just like Jacob does. 12 princes, and they are the dominant controllers of the territory. So any other sons that Abraham sends to them, they are subservient to any of Ishmael's sons. They are living at Ishmael's decree or Ishmael's favor, so to speak, his son's favor. So all of them live under the Ishmaelites. That's by the character structure. Now, that changes a little bit. It's me a little bit like minusculely when Esau goes the same territory. Now, when you look at the mountains of Seir, geographically speaking, Ishmael's territory, it said they all went to mountains of Seir. Mountains of Seir is a large area. And it appears that based on where they likely went, because we're not talking like 100 generations go by here, we're talking a couple of generations that these men have taken over the territory, conquered it, and took it over as their own, that Esau's territory was probably next to or nearby Ishmael's. That Esau eventually dominates all the Ishmaelites, because we call it as Edom. The known territory is Edom, which is named after Esau. So Esau winds up, his descendants, with Jacob's brother, winds up taking over the Ishmaelites' I wouldn't say their full territory, but at least dominates the area that they were originally given by Abraham. So since all of Abraham's sons were sent to the same territory, Ishmael was specified by God to be a ruler over all of them. So Ishmael rules over all of them. So it would appear, based on this toggling back and forth, that the caravan was probably controlled or sent or owned by the Ishmaelites, but the individual people working in the caravan, not necessarily. They could be individual, much like we have a strip mall. Well, there's somebody who owns the entire, all the buildings, every structure there is. But each of the businesses are independently owned. They pay rent. Does it make sense? Like 50 states and United States, same way. We all belong to overall, overarching government, so to speak, but we are so partially independent. So it appears that's probably what was going on. So even though the Ishmaelites would have controlled the caravan, mind you, they're the ones with the swords and the spears and all the great strength, so it makes sense that they would control all caravan routes. The Midianites may have been a subset or a group of people with inside the caravan traveling with them. They're not powerful men at this time in their history. The time of Joseph's around. These are not massive, I have thousands of men under my command. No, we're talking in the hundreds. They're limited in size. They all have to work together as a unit to survive. So that's my only explanation as to what was going on based on just of who was dominant at what point in history and which son was in control of them up to a period of time. Eventually, Ishmael obviously takes off and moves on because Esau takes over everybody. Any comments or questions about this issue or comments you have for this Torah portion? Yes, Larry.
Descended from a different son of Abraham?
They're from Abraham, different wife.
Okay, but they were not, they're not Ishmael's children.
No, not Ishmael's children. Midianites are from Keturah, Abraham and Keturah. He has a whole bunch of sons, Midian being the prominent one.
Israelites or Benjamites. You know, but they were all descended from Jacob, so I guess that's a little different.
When it comes to Israel, well, Jacob obviously has his 12 sons. They all have their own descendancies. In the case of Abraham, he has the two most famous sons, Isaac and Ishmael. But Ishmael, of course, is from Hagar, and then Isaac from Sarah. But Ishmael, as God blessed Hagar, because he was dying, and she was dying because they had sent him off, and he said, don't worry, I'll take care of him. He'll have 12 sons of his own. They'll be princes in their own right. And we have their genealogy listed. I forgot what chapter it's in. It's in Genesis 2. He has Ishmael, his sons, his grandson, his great-grandsons, all listed as far as who dominates what in what territory that's listed there. We also have Esau's lineage as well listed. Their lineage would go well beyond, what's the right word? It's the lists given, on the number of children they had and who begat who, is further forward in history than we are now reading now in Joseph. I mean, that somebody recorded it and then took the information and wrote it down, even though we're still not technically there in historical time period with Joseph. We don't come to that point until Joseph's children are old. But that's how they all worked together in that realm. Yes, Deborah.
Okay, a couple of things. This is all before Moses and the law was given, correct? So you can see why God, when he said, you know, and the brother, he spilt his seed on the ground, and that's why God, and you can start seeing, when you hear these stories, you start seeing why God formulated the law, when he gave that law to Moses, seeing that everything he'd done, because you're thinking, where did God get this law? Well, look at how each lifestyle, what they did, and the things they did, and then the next thing you know, they're up on the hill saying, don't do this and don't do that. Mm-hmm. Also, Joseph is the 11th son raised by other mothers, the brother's right. mother. So that kind of was an interest to me. And then also, Larry was just saying, at that time, Joseph was the savior of Egypt.
He will be.
Yeah, he will be. Yeah. I mean, he was on his way to
that's in the next chapter. Yeah.
Okay. So, it says something too about the 11 stars.
Yes.
And the moon, the stars. And I was thinking about the 11 stars. Is that supposed to be? Because Benjamin is the 12th brother, so I was just right. thinking about that.
It's 11 other stars, because Joseph himself is one of the 12.
Right.
All of his brothers are alive at this point in time.
Right, Benjamin so all is little, of them.
They're all alive, and they're all theoretically available to bow.
Yeah, we know who the 11, but who's the sun and the moon? Is that?
So, yeah, in Jacob interpreted those two characters within his dream. He interpreted them as the sun being himself. Jacob interpreted Joseph's dream, and Jacob interpreted Joseph the moon as Joseph's mother. Now, of course, Joseph's biological mother was dead, Rachel. She's dead. So, but all the other wives, all the other wives, he had two left, Bilhah and Zilpah. They're still both apparently still alive at this point in time in history. I think Leah might be, I can't remember if Leah died yet or not. I've forgotten. Which one?
Yeah.
So in that storyline, mind you, I know it's a little bit, It's confusing because he had all four wives at the same time. Right. Now, normally in our modern day culture, of course, we don't do such things. But a man could have theoretically four wives today. It's wife, divorce or die, another wife, divorce or die, and you go through the fourth wife. Well, each wife is known, then that'd be the biological mom. So we class today, we call them stepmothers. This is the same thing. So even though it is a not his biological mother, he still has to treat her as if she is, which of course was Reuben's screw up that he chose to treat his stepmother not as his mother, but rather his personal use person. His personal, I don't know what the right word is. Concubine. His personal, I can't think of what the word was. His concubine. So you're supposed to treat them as esteem them high, and of course, Reuben brought her low, but Joseph is to esteem her high, and that it is still his is still treated as his mom.
I just thought that was interesting.
It is interesting. Jacob's the one who interpreted Joseph's dream, and he interpreted it correctly.
Jacob did?
Yeah, because all of them interpret it correctly, because what happens? Well, later on, the first time, who bows down to Joseph? Well, 10 of his brothers. The 11th Benjamin's not there yet.
Yeah.
The second time, all 11 bow down because Benjamin's with him. Then the third time, his dad bows down to him. Yeah. So all of them come down to him. So they acknowledge. So each of the events do occur. It just occurs in the progression cycle that's coming later in our Torah portion. Any comments or questions? Yes, Anne.
I find it interesting about Tamar and Judah, and also the comparison with Joseph and Potiphar's wife, because they both wound up with Judah's daughter-in-law, Tamar was promised something that he didn't deliver, so she deceived him, but she took items from him that would prove that he was the person. And the opposite happened with Potiphar. She happened to have his garment in her hand, so she used it against him by saying, you know, that something had happened between them, and so he was found guilty, although he was innocent. Mm-hmm. But the two women are a study in character.
They are. We're going to talk a little about them today in our Torah portion, my little spiel, which I should have enough time to cover all that, hopefully, about those who went and the nature of how they covered. We covered this topic before over the years, but it's always worth revisiting certain components because some things explain a little more deeper than we, because we always cover the exact same thing every time. Any other comments or questions? The staff, the signature, reading the rap that he had?
Yeah,
right. Why would Judah do that, or why would Tamar ask for them? Which would you both? So note in Judah's case, there are two witnesses against him. Tamar and the Adullamite. so he couldn't just say, oh, it wasn't me. Now his friend Hira, the Adullamite, was also sent with the goat to verify this is what happened and was supposed to retrieve those three things. His own friend would say, sorry, Judah, but it really was you. He has a witness. Judah can't just deny it wasn't me. He has a witness that verified it was. And of course, the Adullamite who asked all the men of the town, where is she? Yeah. They had to verify, he asked. And this is, so there's a lot of witnesses in Judah's case. In the case of Joseph, there's no witness. So it's just, it's a one word against the other, so to speak, which is important. He said, she said, exactly. Which, of course, God commands you must have a second witness when it comes to death penalties. And so as a result, she didn't die because the witnesses were against her, him.
Why would he even offer those things up, his identity? Everything is in your seal, in your cape. I mean,
those items were to guarantee, identify who it was.
I mean, but he was desperate.
He may have been desperate. That may be true. I don't know. He was interested, and that's what he found. Any comments or questions? We're going to our little spiel. Oh, yes.
You don't kid around.
Right. Ha, 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 ha. Very nice. Don't kid around. Ah. All right, so we'll go into my spiel then. So first of all, obviously, in the Torah portion begins, of course, the Jacob discussing him settling and such in the territory of his father's sojournings. And the first character we really talk about this Torah portion, of course, is Joseph, not Jacob, or Jacob's other children, because it discusses Jacob's genealogy and such in the first few verses. And it discusses mostly the fact of Joseph, because there are four firstborn sons that Jacob has. Now we learn from that, for as we learn, each wife gave birth, the first child born from each wife was a firstborn son. Now, according to the law, the Torah, which we find out later, which Moses gives to us later on, the rule is, the firstborn is ordered in the order of birth based on the order of the number of wife it is. So firstborn of wife number one is your firstborn. Firstborn of wife number two is your firstborn, even though you may have a firstborn from wife number three that was born earlier. Doesn't matter. It goes by the order of the wife, then the order of the son. So he could have had all four wives, and the first three not given birth, and the fourth one give a whole bunch of kids. Anytime the first three, any one of them gives a birth at all, those first three, though, is the youngest baby. It is considered the firstborn because the wife has seniority. So as Moses explains, when you take a wife and she has no children, you take another wife, she has children, you cannot diminish the first wife, her right, nor her child's inheritance right. And Moses gives us that instruction. Was that? Isaac being the second born, correct. He's a firstborn of Sarah, exactly. And it explains it. So even though Abraham has a second wife, Hagar, in the case of Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar, Hagar being number two, not number one, even she her son was 13 years old or whatever when Isaac was born, because she is classed as wife two, wife one's Sarah, her son is the firstborn of Abraham, even though Ishmael is older. It doesn't make a difference. So it has to follow the order of the wife, then the order of the sons. So when Reuben screwed up, literally, what happened? He loses his firstborn right. Now that is recorded as explains to us in Genesis 35, describes what he did. Genesis 35 discusses, and of course recorded again in 1 Chronicles chapter 5, says that the reason Reuben loses firstborn right is because of what he did with Jacob's other wife, Bilhah. So as a result, even though he was firstborn from Leah, it does not go to Leah's secondborn. It goes to the next wife, in this case would be Rachel, her second position, and her firstborn son. So the birthright correctly goes to Joseph. So we look at this and say, well, look how Jacob treated Joseph. He treated him as a special. He was superior, greater. He was basically loved more by his father than all of the brothers were. That's right. That's exactly what happened. Why? Because he's firstborn. So by firstborn, the brothers interpret the first dream correctly. By firstborn right, who gets to make the decisions for the whole family when Jacob dies? Joseph does. So all those brothers, though they do not like the fact that he is superior to them, even though he's young, he is. By right, he is over them, whether they like it or not. So they have correctly interpreted, will you reign over us? Yes, he will reign over you. Even if the whole story about Egypt going down there and saving them, it didn't even happen. By right, Joseph has rulership over all of his brothers. That's his birthright. He has that right to do so. Okay, so the order of right, according to the Torah, is based on wife first, then sons second. So in this case, the Torah would say Leah was wife number one, so her firstborn son, Reuben number one, is the rightful heir of everything, meaning of the right firstborn right. That's the Torah's explanation. Reuben lost the right because he slept with Bilhah. She wasn't supposed to do that. Big shock, right? So the firstborn right does not go to Simeon, because even though it's the firstborn wife, he doesn't get that right. And it does not go to Bilhah because she's number three, or Zilpah, she's number four. So firstborn right goes from Leah as firstborn wife to Rachel as second wife. Firstborn status goes to Joseph. Does that make sense? So that this is how it's supposed to. So Joseph's in dreams about being the one who's in charge are correct. So even if the story was that they didn't go down to Egypt and none of that stuff happened, they didn't sell Joseph, it wouldn't have mattered. But based on the Torah's instruction, their firstborn status falls to Joseph because Reuben lost it. They didn't, whether they knew it, they didn't agree with it. Reuben had already done so. Reuben messed up earlier, and I won't explain the reasons why because I don't know why. Other than the fact if Reuben does uncover his stepmother, he would then become dominant as the father, so to speak, of her two sons, Dan and Naphtali. Oh, Zebulun was which one was it? Zebulun was Zebulun. All right. Thank you. So Dina was number 7.
What a family story, huh? We think ours is bad.
Yeah, no kidding. Ours is not that bad. Okay. Any questions so far? So let's go through this a little bit. So they correctly interpret, everything correctly interprets Joseph's dreams. That's the way God had set it up. And we learn in the Torah later on that that is actually correct. It should belong to Joseph. And we learn in 1 Chronicles that it in fact does. So when Joseph is brought up, it is pointed out that he becomes a dominant one as a first counting in the inheritance rights. And of course, in Chronicles, it discusses that he is divided into two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh. And of course, Ephraim being the dominant of the two tribes, which we'll learn all those details as we continue on in our Torah portions as time goes on throughout the year. Jacob, of course, said, so our story starts out with Joseph because he is the dominant character, so which is what matters to us all. Now, Joseph, his dreams. Now, here's our problem. You guys know sibling rivalries, those of you who have had siblings. We all laugh and chuckle because I've been there. We know what it's like. So there are problems, sibling rivalries. But there's also a competing problem too. So in the book of Amos, which is our Haftorah portion we won't get to today, Amos chapter 3, it specifies that prophets, their jobs, when God wants to do something, Amos chapter 3, he explains to us, this is the first 8 verses to talk about this, in Amos chapter 3, it says that when God wants to do something, he reveals it to his prophets first, right? Amos 3, let's go to Amos 3. It doesn't hurt to read it. Yep. Amos 3, chapter 7. Yeah. He reveals it to his prophet first. Now, you can debate and argue who is a prophet and who isn't. Who's making it up? That's a whole other issue. We won't discuss. Yeah. That's beyond our scope for today's discussion. But Amos 3, we'll read the first 8 verses. Hear this word that Jehovah has spoken against you, O children of Israel, against the whole family which I brought up from the land of Egypt, saying, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. Therefore, I will punish you for all your iniquities. Can two walk together unless they are agreed? Will a lion roar in the forest when he has no prey? Will a young lion cry out of his den if he has caught nothing? Will a bird fall into a snare on the earth where there is no trap for it? Will a snare spring up from the earth if it has caught nothing at all? If a trumpet is blown in the city, will not the people be afraid? If there is calamity in the city, will not Jehovah have done it? Surely Jehovah God does nothing unless he reveals his secrets to his servants, the prophets. A lion has roared, and who will not fear? Jehovah has spoken, and who cannot but prophesy? So that was, now Amos, of course, is going through a long explanation as far as proper conduct and what is not acceptable throughout the people of Israel and God's people in general. In most of Amos's book, you will notice you go through the sequence. He laments and gets angry with people and their conduct, how they oppress those who are worse off than they are. Now, I have a question for you. Don't answer this. Think about this. Sibling rivalries. When you want to lift yourself up, what's the first thing you do? Squish. Push your sibling down. You're right there. Sibling rivalries tend to use the oppressive technique. They make the less sibling feel like scum or treat them like such and make you feel like you're better. Now, does that make you better? No, it's just how humans react. So when you have sibling rivalries, is it not in the nature and expected nature of the brothers of Joseph to try to oppress him, to make themselves be lifted up? It is the nature to do so. It's what siblings do. They do it quite often, all the time, actually. Testify that my own experience and kids and everything else. That's what they do. So the rivalries, that's how it works. So it's pretty typical, pretty normal. Now, in the case of Joseph, though, he has an obligation. Because if God reveals something, in the case of a dream, to Joseph, what does Ezekiel tell us? If God reveals something to his prophet and the prophet does not say something, what happens? He's not a prophet, or anything that God had planned, the prophet's the guilty one. As it is Ezekiel 33, it specifies that if God reveals it to his prophets and his prophets do not declare the words, not speak them out and share them, whatever happens will happen to people, whatever is happening, but the guilt will be upon the prophet who didn't speak. So it's the obligation, whether it is in your best physical interest, in the case Joseph was not in his best interest to speak, but whether it was in your physical interest or not, your obligation is to speak it. Now, there may be better ways than what Joseph chose, but there's still, he has an obligation to share what's being explained. Now, whether or not the people understand what's being explained in the dream doesn't matter. It's still his job to share the dream in some capacity. Ezekiel 33 discusses this. That's the first 9 verses. Discuss the prophet's job or instruction is when God gives you a message, you by obligation are to share the message, whether it is in your best interest. Now mind you, how many prophets were killed for their messages that they sent? All of them. So whether it's in your personal best interest doesn't matter. Your job is still to share it anyway. So it's not an easy place to be in the prophet's place. It's actually a rather unpleasant life. Though some of us may envy what they understand and know, reality is it's not a very pleasant life. They would gladly, I'm sure, give most of it up for peace and quietness. Okay, so we have obviously confirmation of the dreams that Joseph has after Joseph explains them and shares them. We have dreams from both confirmed by his brothers, and of course, confirmed by Jacob as well. They all interpret pretty much the same way. I'm not going to discuss any more details regarding that. Now, we do mention, as Larry had pointed out, Reuben does not appear to be in agreement with the conspiracy against Joseph, at least not in full. I would argue probably not really much even in part, and that his intent appears to be to save Joseph, which, granted, Reuben's not dumb. He knows what he did. He knows he lost his first right-born status. He understands that part. He's not arguing that. He's not lamenting that he's not firstborn. He is noting that though he cannot be firstborn status anymore, he can at least treat the firstborn as he would like them to treat him. So Reuben still has the basic character that you'd want for a firstborn son. If you were firstborn, would you not want your brothers to treat you correctly? Well, yes. So what's Reuben? Yeah, they're supposed to. So what's Reuben doing? He's treating his brother, the firstborn, correctly, giving him, preserve him when you can, return him and safeguard him and bring him to somewhere is safe. He is treating someone, his brother, the same way Reuben would have liked to have been treated. Would you not like, if you were the firstborn, to be treated well? Reuben would like to have been treated well. He did something wrong. He lost that, but he's still going to treat others the proper way. So he's still an honorable man. I actually like the character of Reuben for various reasons. Not all what he did, mind you, but the character of the man, as far as, because I see him as a man who changes. Like all men, we screw up, but he goes through that screw up and walks through it and comes out and says, now I'm going to be better than I was before. That's an important character trait, and Reuben seems to have that. So he repeats this type of example, trying to redeem the character he is. Of course, Jacob says, no, sorry, I'm not going to accept your redemption, but we'll discuss that at another time. So it does not appear to be, of course, inside this conspiracy in the same way. Now, here's a question for you, though, which there is no answer, so I'm asking it more like a rhetorical question. So all the brothers know they threw him in the pit, right? Now, Reuben, of course, sees he's gone. Now, Reuben may not necessarily know what happened to him. Reuben doesn't, nothing that says they explained to Reuben what they did. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't, I don't know, but it doesn't say they did or didn't. So I'm going to benefit the doubt, I'm going to assume, big assumption, that they didn't explain anything what happened to Reuben. But they all conspired for their dad. So Reuben never came forward and said what happened. Judah never did. No one did. And I have to ask a question for you then. For all the years that Joseph is in Egypt and he became head of Potiphar's household, don't you think he would at least once considered sending word back to his family, saying, I'm still alive, here I am? Now, you, if you were in this situation, would you send word back to your dad? You emailed today. We do it instantly, a text message. Hey, I'm still alive, right? We do it pretty regularly. So there is something within the character or understanding of Joseph for him not to attempt to contact his father while he's in charge in Potiphar's house. I do not know what it was necessarily. My personal opinion, which is just an opinion, is that Joseph understood something that he wasn't supposed to contact his dad. That's my personal opinion. I can't say for certain, but for whatever reason, he did not notify Jacob, I'm still alive, I'm still down here, and I'm not destroyed. Now, we can debate the reasons and why it didn't happen, but it is an interesting dynamic because most siblings, when it comes to sibling rivalries, will not allow themselves to be diminished too low. They'll lift themselves back up again. Hey, you can't treat me that way, brothers. I'm greater than this, and I will lift myself back up again. But Joseph doesn't do that. He had the power to do it. Yeah, he was high official within Potiphar's house. He may have enjoyed his lifestyle, but he had the power to do it. He could easily send messages. At any point in time, he could have notified, and later on, he could have easily notified. So Joseph had to have understood something or accepted something that this was not by happenstance of his the poor content of his brothers, but rather this was intentional. Now, I do not know how he understood. Whatever it was, it's just speculation. But it is an interesting character trait of Joseph to understand that though he has apparently a ability to understand God or speak to him in dreams in some form, he never attempts to better his own personal life and recover what his previous life was. Though later when he talks to cupbearer and baker and says, hey, you know, this is unjust, I shouldn't be here, he does acknowledge that, but he doesn't try to fix the problem. You know what I mean? He doesn't try to go, or previously didn't try to fix the problem. It's an interesting thing about Joseph. I do not understand it yet. I'm sure someday God will reveal it, but I don't understand it just yet. He reveals things periodically.
When he was young, he enjoyed a lot of drama.
That's true. When he was young, he enjoyed drama. That's true. That's true. Okay, now let's go to the next story, because this is a tale of two brothers, so to speak. I think I have enough time to hear both of them. So the second brother, of course, is Judah. I'm going to take this sheet off. Judah, we'll talk about him. Now, these, mind you, the Torah portion is so conveniently locating both these stories back to back so we can get to compare them side by side and understand the nature of both men, both Judah as well as Joseph and their scenario, which, of course, I believe, I think it was Deborah that had mentioned it, or somebody, it was Anne, regarding the comparison of both the women of Judah as well as the women in Joseph's story. So Judah, of course, obviously, you know, it specifies at that time Judah separates himself. I don't sure the exact timing, what that means at that time, whether that was before or after, because Judah has three sons through Shua's daughter, and then, of course, has two more sons, Zerah and Perez, through Tamar in the story. And they become grown adults, have children of their own by the time they move down to Egypt. So I'm not quite sure the exact timing of everything. I do accept and realize that our Torahs are not written in chronological order. It is subject matter based. Remember that. It's always subject matter based, not chronology. We as humans like chronology, what happened when. Don't do that. God doesn't care what happened when. He cares about what happened and how. The details of how and why are more important than the when. And it's important to understand that, because otherwise we tend to shove and squeeze together lots of things back to back to back as if things happen all at once in prophecies, and they don't. They're dragged out over many, many, many years of God intervenes, happens here, and then a generation or two will go by before another prophecy is fulfilled here. They're not squeezed together in a single month or single week of events. They're drawn out. So God does not interest himself in chronology because it doesn't matter. He does interest himself in subject matters. So Judah and Joseph. Yes, Messiah does come through Judah's line, and that is explained to us in Samuel. Actually, in a lot of places, but Samuel covers the details of how that's supposed to happen, the book of Samuel, and all the nature of when you're dealing with King David. So that's explained. Judah and his life and Messiah are explained in the book of Samuel because it's in the role of David and how that's done. We can cover that some other time. It's very lengthy, and I don't have time to cover it today. So Judah and Joseph, I'm not going to write down every comparison, but they're all, we've done this before, so we'll do this again. Of course, obviously, now, in the case when Judah was trying to convince his brothers what to do, being regarding with Joseph, and convince them to sell him rather than killing him. Now, the brothers did, of course, hear and respect Reuben's request, throw him in the pit, but they wound up respecting Judah's request to sell him instead of killing him, because the brothers had no intention of letting Joseph live. But Judah, of course, because he agreed to try to convince him to sell him, they heeded his voice. They listened to Judah. So Judah, by default, at that moment in that conversation, temporarily became the head of his brothers. Maybe not necessarily Reuben, but at least the rest of his brothers. So, of course, in this instance, there are certain similarities. Judah goes down to, what's the town he goes to? I forgot. Down to the Adullamite. Down to Adullamite. I'm going to abbreviate because I don't have time to write all of them down. Joseph goes down to Egypt. And of course, after they were comparing both these individuals. Now, of course, the Egyptian Potiphar was most likely a eunuch, hence why his wife was interested. That's the nature of the Egyptians. So anyway, so he was a eunuch, but he of course becomes head of his master's house. In the case of Joseph, the wife is forbidden from him. Okay, forbidden yeah. And of course, in the case of Judah, he has a daughter-in-law, Tamar, who's also forbidden from him. Now, these two men treat these, I don't know the Potiphar's wife's name, so I can't write it down, so forgive me for that. Now, these two men treat these women very differently from each other. Now, case of Judah, he understands that she's forbidden from him because while he knows that she is his daughter-in-law, he understands that process. That's good. He understands some basic fundamentals of what is right and wrong. In the case of Judah and the case of Joseph, they react and they work differently with these two women that they have to deal with. So, of course, in Tamar's case, which is interesting, so as Anne had pointed out, I'll write this down rather quickly, so go to I'm not going to cover everything, but at least certain points. So the case of Tamar, she removes her garment and covers her face. See, Judah believes that she's a harlot. And see, she requires the signet ring or the components. So signet, staff, and a belt or some sort of wrap or a belt. I'm not sure what that looks like. I don't know the details of the garb at that time, so don't hold that against me. And of course, Tamar is accused of harlotry. Now, note, Judah believes she's a harlot. Of course, she's accused of being a harlot, and I'm not saying she isn't. She's ordered to death. And then she's spared due to the evidence. And then, of course, let's see here. It concludes, Judah concludes she's more right. More righteous. Yeah, it does make it public. More righteous than Judah. And then, of course, she has two sons, which is Zerah and Perez. We're going to cover these two men shortly. I have enough time to do this if I do it right. Now, in the case of Joseph, there are certain similarities too. Not everything's identical, but there are certain similarities. So, of course, we have obviously Potiphar's wife is forbidden from him. She acts as a harlot, mind you. Yeah. So she acts. Yeah, watch the movies you watch. Be careful of that. She acts a harlot, takes his garment. But note, she claims he takes it off. She takes the garment, but she says he takes it off. It's not actually true, but she claims he takes it off. She testifies against him with the garment. Yeah, but she takes it off. So she claims he takes it off, and that she left his garment. That he left it here, as if he disrobed or partially disrobed. So it's important that because in the case of Tamar, she actually takes off her garments. So the fact of taking off one's evidence of what one is, and then reconceding oneself as something which one is not. Tamar took off what she was, her widow, considered herself as she was not a harlot. Now in his case, he didn't take it off. She took it off, but she claimed. He took it off, and she claims that he, as a Hebrew, came to make sport with us. So changing as being an honorable man changed what he was, by her words, from an honorable man to a dishonorable man. So took his garment off and changed his identity as from what was good to what was now is evil. So she testifies that he is now the evil one, I guess you can call it, or what he testifies, he changes who she changes by her testimony who he is. So testifies, Joseph is, I'm going to abbreviate, simple by this, okay? Bad. too much writing. So testify Joseph bad. Note, of course, in the case of Tamar, she is testified, of course, she's bad too, for different reasons. Now, okay, so in this, Joseph is, right. Now, she's acting like a harlot, but she also testifies that Joseph treated her like one. In the fact, he wants to make sport with me, obviously to use me in that general term. There's also, of course, Joseph is ordered to prison. Now, mind you, this is an Egyptian prison, which is not the same as, you know, certain prisons, but most prisoners don't live long in prison at this time in history. Now, today, we don't have that problem. We have great health care, dental work, the whole thing they have for prisoners. Yeah. It's not really so bad, but at this time in history, prison is a miserable place, far worse than is our modern-day prisons. So it is not intended that a prisoner survive. Yeah, don't worry about prisoners surviving. It's not a big deal. They don't care. Let's see, order prison. And then, while he's in prison, while he's there, I find it fascinating that Joseph is lifted up as greater or more righteous than the other prisoners. So in that he was lifted up and put on top of or in charge of all the prisoners, and the warden didn't even care. Joseph take care of it all. I mean, imagine giving the keys over to the prison inmates. What happens? not usually good things, okay? The prison inmates tend to get themselves out and do what they wish to do. So you don't usually turn the keys over to them. At least I don't know if anybody is doing that on purpose or not. No blame. But then they have the two dreamers, the baker and the cupbearer, the wine guy. Now, I'm not saying these two stories are identical. I'm just saying these two stories have a lot of similarities. There's enough similarities. They're side by side. They're structured based on how they're designed. And it helps us understand the nature of these two men. Now, one man, of course, is supposed to be the righteous Judah, who isn't all that righteous. Nothing evil, but there's things, his character flaws. And one's supposed to be the firstborn Joseph, who obviously performs far better than Judah does. Now, in the case of these instances, we also see a little bit the nature of the two women that we're dealing with, both Tamar and, of course, Potiphar's wife. Now, Tamar and Potiphar, technically speaking, neither one did a good thing. Now, look at it. Tamar, pretending to be a harlot, sleeping with her father-in-law, is that a positive thing? No, it's gross. We don't do that. Potiphar's wife, bored one day, seeing a guy that works for her, says, hey, I'll sleep with him. Is that a positive thing? No, that's not acceptable either. So both conducts are unacceptable. But so both women do two bad, I use the term loosely, bad things or negative things to change or alter their lives and the lives of people around them. Now, Tamar's, of course, Judy determines she is more right than I am. Now, of course, in the case of Joseph, because God lifts Joseph up in prison, God determines Joseph is more right than Potiphar and his wife and the prisoners. So in the case of Judah, he's making the determination based on the evidence of the garment. Both Judah judges based on the garment, and Potiphar himself judges based on a garment. But one judge judges rightly, and one judge judges wrongly. And that Potiphar believes his wife. Now, mind you, think about this for a minute. Yeah, he's not dumb. And it says that she tried to coax Joseph to lie with her, and this is the time which no other man was in the house. Well, what about the other times? Day after day after day. Were other staff around? Probably. Were they aware of what she was doing? Probably. So they weren't dumb. And if the other staff people weren't dumb, and no, this probably is not the first time we're doing this thing, who didn't open their mouths? The other staff members. They could have said, wait a minute, Potiphar, sir, my lord. Now, here's a problem, though, of course. If he doesn't agree with them, they lose their lives. Right. So it's a risk. They're sticking their own neck out for what is right. That's not an easy thing to do, to stick it out for what is right. But what's a prophet's job? Stick your neck out because it's right. So it's not easy to do, and you have to make that decision. Yes.
You notice that too, is that ever since Joseph has come around, everything's changed over there. So he's had to have known that this man who won't ever behave in an inappropriate way has all of a sudden
changed.
But and he doesn't want to be embarrassed because it's like if you're gone traveling and you come home and you find out your wife is trying to sleep with the cook or something, So he's had to know deep down,
Well, and we look back and I did not agree with it today, I read it to it in previous times. Leviticus 19 and 20 discusses the nature of the conduct of the men and women within Egypt and within Canaan. And those two chapters discusses the fact that using Leviticus 19 and 20, the inappropriate sexual relationships between different peoples that were common in Egypt and common in Canaan. And those things which God said, I abhor these are disgusting, don't do them, and kill these people because it's so awful, they're going to make your people do the same thing. So God was quite upset with the sexual misconduct of both the Egyptians as well as the Canaanites. And God tells Israel, don't do this, don't act like this. This example for Potiphar, shows us the type of the nature of his wife and what the culture of Egypt is like. Now, it says that Joseph points out and explains to her, hey, I'm in charge of the whole household. The only kept cut from me is you because you're his wife. There is nothing that says he kept her from anybody else. There's nothing that says that he didn't share her with others.
Okay.
but it's not the same with Joseph. He may have done so. And if we read book Leviticus 19 and 20, as God describes, or Moses actually is the one describing it, the conduct of what Moses lived like, what Moses saw when he was living in Egypt, it would not be surprising in any way if he did share her with others, but not with Joseph. Does that make sense? Because note, Moses points out that the Egyptians see Hebrews as abhorrent. So the Potiphar may have shared her with other Egyptians. We don't know. And it wouldn't surprise me if he did, because Moses points out it's disgusting. What they did is really gross. But so that conduct from her may be completely normal and acceptable. The other staff members say, yeah, she does it all the time. We've all been there, right? I don't know. But in the case of Joseph, it was obviously a disgusting case, and he held his own on that one. Now, so we have similarities to these stories, but there's a similarity I want to bring to your attention, which I didn't cover last time we talked about this topic. I will end this next like 5 minutes here. Zerah and Perez, the cupbearer and the baker. The baker. These two characters are also, with inside these two stories, they're also a character worth looking at in the comparison of Judah and Joseph. Take this sheet off. So the case of Judah, we have Zerah and his brother Perez. Now, in these two brothers, Zerah is officially the firstborn. He's the one with the hand, the scarlet thread. But Perez, the one who actually comes out first, breached or broke through.
Yeah, broke through.
Yeah, he's breached. He broke through, and though he was not biologically the firstborn, because Zerah was, Perez actually becomes a firstborn. Have you ever noticed that? Which line is David from? Perez, not from Zerah. Which line is the Messiah from? Perez. Not from Zerah. Who's the most dominant and winds up taking over the entire people of Israel? David's, Perez's line does. And the book of Ruth discusses, of course, the same details. Perez, though he was not firstborn, these two boys swap positions. Perez becomes the default firstborn because God blesses his line over Zerah's line, though Zerah is the biological firstborn. So God swapped these two boys. Well, look at the same character system with the baker and the cupbearer, the wine bearer. So the wine guy and the baker. Now it says Pharaoh was upset with both of them, threw them both in prison. Now I don't know the details of why, it doesn't really matter. But the baker has a dream. The cupbearer, the wine guy, has a dream too. So they both have these dreams, and of course, both interpreted by Jacob. The wine guy lives. Sorry, Joseph. And the baker dies. These two men, who were both in prison, both they were up high or lifted up in Pharaoh's household. One was brought low, swapped his position from a life of good as a baker to a life of now it's now ended. And then one who went from the life that was good down to prison, brought back up again. These men had their lives turned around also, because the wine guy was living well. He was in Pharaoh's house. There's a chamberlain. That's what the English word uses. So yeah, he's the wine taster as well as the wine supplier. So the chamberlain wine, he goes down to prison. So he winds up living, but he goes down to prison. Both these men go to prison. They went from They both went from high positions down to prison. Now, is that the opposite of each other? Being in charge to being in prison. I call them opposites, because one's in charge and one's very low, right? So they swap positions from their previous position. Now, in the case one's head, one's tail, right? So in the case of this, the wine bearer, they both go to prison, but he comes out and lifts it back up, switches position. The baker comes down and just dies. So they both wind up going through a change in their lives. Now, Zerah and Perez went through change in their lives. Tamar and Judah also changed their lives. So we have these stories of these men and these women and their stories within these two chapters, two and a half chapters, of actually switching of positions. God's literally reshuffling people around. And it's quite interesting to know, why is God shuffling people around? What's the reason to shuffle them around? To tell us something. To tell us something. What's he telling us? We've learned the nature of these two men, Judah and Joseph, how they treat others, how they treat themselves, how they treat these women that they were dealing with. We learned that God rearranged them or flipped them in their stories, because Joseph, being the head, was brought down all the way down to prison. And then, of course, brought back up again, we'll learn later about in the next Torah portion, as far as how he gets back out of prison. But he brings himself all the way down. Now, Judah, of course, lifted himself up above his brothers temporarily for the decision-making time. And then he himself was brought down to her. Remember the Torah? If a man and a woman are committing adultery, what happens? They both die. Well, what Judah did with Tamar, by Torah's definition, because she was betrothed to someone else, his son, and was his wife, that was adultery. So both Judah and Tamar, by Torah's definition, should have been executed for what their conduct was. So he had raised himself up over his brothers, Judah did, temporarily for the decision-making to save Joseph and to sell him, but then he was brought down to deserving of death, and rightly deserving of death. As was a Joseph, was wrongly accused and did not rightly deserve death. He quite the opposite. He deserved something better. So both, we have the story of both Joseph and Judah, which we discussed earlier. Their story is very similar, but they had different outcomes. That Judah deserved what he got and actually deserved far worse. Joseph did not deserve what he got and deserved far better. Eventually, Joseph receives what is better. And Judah, of course, over a long period of time, through Perez, of King David, eventually receives what's better. Did Judah deserve to be head of his brothers? No. But what eventually happens, as we know our Torahs and our Tanakhs and the else, the Messiah himself, what happens? He becomes, over time, generations later, head over his brothers. So it's an interesting story to note that when we're dealing with characters within our Torah and our Tanakh, and the whole book, character positions are where we think they belong based on their conduct alone is insufficient. That will give you the wrong final answer. Final answer comes over a period of time. We started earlier that said, no, that Reuben is a dynamic character. He changes over time. As he goes through a series of events, his character, the nature of the man, grows and moves forward to a more beneficial place. Well, case of Joseph, his character was in fact different when he was a young man. It appears to him exalting himself, right or wrong, in the form of the dreams, the way he shared them. He eventually goes through a very long series of story and changes. The man himself changes his character and becomes greater than he was. And God, of course, then lifts him up. Judah, on the other hand, goes from where I was, tries to lift himself up temporarily, and God brings him very, very, very low. Then over a period of time, he learns, as it says, he knew Tamar no more. He never knew her again. He then learns, and his character then winds up changing. And we learn that later on when he deals with Joseph, not realizing who Joseph is, with the whole going before him and asking for food and Benjamin, all that stuff. We see the character of Judah change and what he went through. So God is showing us that a character, you can actually swap from one place completely around to the other based on your conduct. How do you live? Do you learn from your mistakes? Do you maintain your mistakes? There's a difference. It's the nature of how to learn these things. And it helps us, the Torah portion, to compare these two men to see that. We see two men that went through a series of events to actually change who they became and grew up better than they were. Than they were, or where they were, use the term loosely, destined to go. Because where their actions, where they were headed, was in one path. But both men's paths took a wild detour and headed somewhere totally different than what was expected. So Perez, of course, winds up, as we mentioned before, becomes the line which Messiah comes through, and of course becomes the dominant one. And they wind up screwing up again with David, but we'll deal with that later. So in the case, and that's many, many, many years later. In the case of these, the chamberlain, though he survived and was brought back up, what was his failure point? He forgot. He forgot. And we'll learn later, Perez's line, they forget too. We'll learn about that some other time. Perez's line, many years later, also forget. They also forget what their responsibility they have. So the same thing happens, both of these men who benefited from this exchange of their superior, they both follow the same route. They both forget. Now, Perez forgets when it comes to David and he's dealing with Absalom, but we'll discuss that later. So I'm out of time. So I didn't get to everything I was going to cover today. I was going to cover Reuben and comparing him to with Absalom and Amnon and David and Judah and Joseph and others, but I didn't get around to doing that today. So maybe some other time. Any comments or questions about our Torah portion that I did cover that we can discuss? Yes, Deborah.
We have something similar, I believe, that's going to be coming down. I think we're going to experience this again.
Yes, in a different fashion.
With Joseph, because God said in the end days, you will not be famine for food, but it will be for the word.
Yeah, there's an interesting nature. If you have the opportunity to read the story cycle, the storyline through Samuel, because David is living out Messiah's life, King David is. Samuel, it's well, to be fair, the focus area that you'd be interested in is the time which David's dealing with Absalom, because it's David deals with Absalom, because it is a repetition of what Messiah went through while he was alive and what he's going to go through when he returns. So you look, read about that very closely and very carefully, slowly read through each word to understand what's happening, and you'll understand those natures. You don't have to use Hebrew words. The English does translate it fair enough, that story. But that is an extension of this story here, where this story continues on in these natures. So you can learn more about that, and that will help explain the repetition that occurs in the nature of Joseph and this character with his brothers. Any questions or comments? We'll conclude with a prayer then. Almighty God, our great Father, thank you for our Shabbat, a day of rest, our time to study and to worship you and to learn what is good and right. Father, please bless us and help us to share the great things you taught us. Father, we ask you to help us to understand and see and open our eyes, for there are good things for us to learn, to help us in our path and our walks. We praise you, Lord, and ask your blessing in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.